Now, if Kevin would like to step up to the mark to chair the discussion, yeah, I'm sure, hopefully it'll be plenty of interesting discussion, because, yeah, Janet's certainly given us a lot to think about and chew over. So, I'll hand over to Kevin to do the honours. Thank you.
Okay. As a party, we're well known for our tolerance of views. I'll be asking for questions or opinions. And to remember that if someone gives an opinion, it's their opinion. And we don't attack the person that says it, but we may attack their opinion or criticise their opinion. So, who wants to be the first speaker? Gentleman at the back.
Janet, you mentioned limited time. And you're obviously involved in environmental issues. And I just wonder, last night the speaker was talking about some aspects of transitional arrangements. I just wondered whether those kind of issues lead you to the idea that we need to adapt or change our perspective on things. That's the party's perspective.
Well, I think we do. As time goes by, I don't think there's any doubt. The fundamental principles remain the same, but the approach to them, I think, does change. Definitely. I haven't been around the party for that long. Was it, I don't know, 15 years maybe? But I've certainly seen, coming here, for instance, and reading all the stuff that we have, I don't think there's any doubt that a lot of people in the party are adapting, and they bring ideas which fit. They actually fit with the principles, but they're just approached from a different angle. Of course it's necessary. Time goes by, everything changes through the generations, and it has to be. You couldn't possibly be doing something that was like written whatever this is as if it's No, it's how you approach what angle you come at from these different things. That's the best way I can say it. I don't know if anybody's got any better way of putting it than me, or a different way of putting it from me, but that's how I feel about it.
Any questions? Gentleman with the mauve shirt, please. Anyone after that can take two? And this gentleman here. Afterwards. Yeah? Howard? Any question?
Yeah. It's not well with his shirt.
Oh, sure. No, I've got some. Was you making a mauve point or something?
Yeah. Jenna talked about all the lies and misrepresentation that take place within capitalism. Of course, there are loads of lies and misrepresentation. By all sides, by the Russians, by the Americans, by the Chinese, the Syrians, by the Iranians, they're all at it, we know. And it's to do with the geopolitical power struggles that are taking place throughout the world, and these are usually over control of economic resources of one kind or the other. That goes on all the time, it always has been in capitalism, but what in a way makes me sort of more sad and more depressed is the stuff that isn't to do with lies and misrepresentation, because everybody knows about it and accepts it. You walk through the streets of Birmingham or London or Manchester or Liverpool, and there are loads of people begging for money. And people seem to accept that this is a fundamental part of human existence. It's not a lie, because you can't conceal it. People know about the massive gulf between the very rich, the owners of capital, and the vast majority. And indeed, the gulf in amongst the resources that the vast majority are able to enjoy. Accept it. For many years I worked in a university, and there are lots of people working in universities. There are relatively well-paid administrators who maybe earn £80,000 or £90,000 a year, And there are sort of porters who may be earn 15 or 20,000. And this is something that people sort of find absolutely all right and perfectly acceptable. So, as I say, what gets me down isn't so much the things that are concealed, the lies, the misrepresentation. What gets me down more is the things that are obvious and that the vast majority of people seem to regard as a fundamental part of the human lot. And that's what we've really got to overcome if we want to, you know, the imagination that's necessary to achieve socialism to spread. You don't need to answer that. That's just an observation, really.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I wonder if it's just part of that they see it, and it's almost... I mean, I've heard it from so many people and within the family. So what can we do? So, they'll shrug their shoulders. What can I do? Or they can see it and don't like it, even. And that, yes, it does make you feel despair, actually. I go with that.
Turn a minute to check shirt.
Just three reflections on... So I really enjoyed what you said, but just three reflections on one lies and the other United Nations and the other, you know, global warming. You know, just three reflections. Lies presupposes truth, as it were. You know, it presupposes truth. And 20 or 30 years ago, I wrote a little article because there was so much in academia, anyway, amongst anthropology and philosophers, that basically arguing that there's no real world there anyway. You know, it's all created by our mind. And also, there's no such things as truth. There's no such thing as truth. And I wrote a little article, this is 30 years ago, I wrote a little article in defence of realism and truth. You know, what I find quite interesting is over the last sort of decade or so, as the whole conception of truth has been devalued as a concept, and the archetype of this, of course, is Trump. You know, not only truth is there's no such thing as truth. There are alternative facts, so you can invent your facts as well if you want. So now that's my first reflection. This one, not only the lies that are being said, but the undermining of the notion of truth, that you can say true things about the world, particularly the political world. My second reflection on the United Nations. I've got lots of friends, mostly of Quakers, and they're very, very keen on the United Nations. I think you have to remember that United Nations is a complete misnomer. It's a complete misnomer. It's not a union of nations as ethnic kind of groups. It's a union of states. And it's so rigged with the way it's organised that the most powerful states, as part of the Security Council, control it. It's also worth remembering the whole idea of kind of human rights, as it were, that the United Nations in 46 and that period that invented the the human rights, as it were, was quite different from the French one. The French one, you had a right to go against the government. That was a fundamental human right. The one that now we have with the United Nations since the Second World War, that the states themselves have a right, not the individual, but the states themselves have a right to abrogate the human rights if they're under threat. So any state can declare a state of emergency, and we have no rights at all. It's well worth remembering.
Yeah.
The third thing, I'm really pleased you mentioned my mate Murray Bookchin, as it were, and it's about global warming. I mean, I was involved in demonstrations and involved in ecological issues way back in the 60s and 70s, you know. And at the time, there were three figures that I really thought... A lot of it is put to the American biologist, Rachel Carson.
Yes.
But actually, I mean, I got a lot of time from Rachel Carson. But to me, the real figures that were important in the 60s and 70s in relation to emphasising that capitalism wasn't just about economics and it wasn't just about politics, it wasn't just about socialism, it was also about the earth, and it was an ecological thing. The capitalism wasn't not only undermining human relationships, it was actually undermining the whole ecosystem, really. And so, and there were the three figures which I mentioned to you yesterday, which to me in the 60s and 70s were important. One was Barry Cominer, who was a Marxist. The other was René Dubois, who was a microbiologist, and the other was Murray Bookchin. And what they were saying is that the reason for the ecological crisis had to be put down to capitalism. You know, it wasn't that we that humans are by nature evil, okay? It was nothing to do with religion. It was nothing to do with anthropocentrism. It wasn't because there was too many people on the world. The reason we have an ecological crisis is given the nature of capitalism and its search for profit.
Absolutely.
And that's what they're saying. What is also interesting about these chaps in the 1960s, Bookchin, René Jubar, and also Mumford as well, was saying that scientists had shown that given the emissions of oil and coal, the importance of oil and coal, and Mumford talked about it was a Paleolithic technical thing, it was actually warming up the planet. In the 1960s and 70s, there were a lot of scientists advocating this and arguing. It's this global crisis, the global warming, is nothing new.
Yeah.
Scientists have known about it for years, and people like Bookchin have been emphasising it for years. But what I think is quite interesting, whereas they were using this as a radical critique of capitalism, now it's a state of fact. And actually, capitalism and people are really embracing it in order to promote capitalism. So we have the argument now, whereas somebody like Bookchin was saying, for goodness sake, nuclear power is actually against the Earth. It's really problematic form of... Now people are arguing the way to save the planet is to build nuclear power stations. So capitalists have really got bought into it, really. And the most supporters of global warming and emphasising global warming tend to be...
I'm asking you to bring this to a conclusion because there's quite a lot of people here.
Sorry.
No, just finish off.
I was finishing off. I just had these three things to say. So what I'm saying is that this now... I just read a newspaper article yesterday about... I don't know if you know about it. There was a great conference to discuss global warming, and it was organised by Google. Okay, and the great and the good went to some island in the Caribbean, I think it was, to discuss global warming. They all went in their private jets, and it included Prince Harry as well.
Oh, yeah, that was it, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, nothing to add. If I'd had a lot longer to talk all day, that would be one of the things I would have gone into in more detail. Absolutely. So thank you for expanding on what I was wanting to say. That I could have included that. Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Could we have a female contribution, please?
Oh, you're sexist.
No. I'd want to be fair about this. Young lady. Yeah, please. Do you want to stand up or stay there?
Oh, stand up.
Sorry.
Me?
Yeah.
Or one leg. Or eyes.
Oh.
What does your vision of socialism look like? What would it look like in our society today? And also, how might we achieve that?
Wow, how long have we got? my vision of socialism, if it was today...
Yeah.
That's it. Where do we want to begin? I tell you what, let's have a really good long chat about it later. But what would I say, basically? I don't think I could envisage it right now, because there's too much, so much negative in the way that's got to be pushed out of the way to actually... I don't see it now. I see it the sooner the better. But you said, how do we get there? And how do we get there is by talking to people endlessly and explaining anything that we know about it, anything that we can think about it, that we feel, I think it really helps if you... I'm not talking about being emotional, but if you really feel it strongly yourself, because I don't think anybody is going to grasp the whole of this thing and want to be talking about the whole of the different aspects of socialism, because it would take lots of time. So, you know, it's like when you're talking to someone about a particular subject, it's then always trying to present our way of looking at it, rather than the way that they've accepted looking, most people accepted looking at it. And it means lots of explanations, forever. And if you actually are talking to people about it, like, you know, who are interested, then you can spread the thoughts, we've got all kinds of literature, we've got all kinds of online stuff, You can hand them your pamphlets or your socialist standard, what have you. And I think it's up to every one of us. If I say every minute of the day, now please don't think that means you're rushing up to people, blah, 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 blah. It's not like that. It's just as part of your daily life, you are doing your best to be what you want it to be, if that makes sense. But I'd love for some other people to say what they've got to say about this, because, I mean, there's so much to be done, so much to be done, because so many people don't know anything about it, right?
I'll take from Jim and then the young lady here. Thank you.
I used to work for the GLC many years ago on a tree nursery, and we planted virtually all the trees which are in London now, 40, 50 foot tall. Anyway, when I first went there, it was all beautiful fields with a million trees. We would hoe that, you know, use a hoe to remove the weeds. Then all of a sudden they said, we've got to move forward, so we used them, insecticides, pesticides, herbicides, all these chemicals, and we noticed the tree growth was slowing down. They weren't speeding up, they were slowing down. We spent less time weeding, the trees were slowing down. Then they said, we're going to buy Agent Orange from America.
Oh, lovely.
To defoliate these trees at a certain time of the year, which will increase the growth. The trees will grow 25% faster if you remove the leaves at a certain time. So this guy came over from America. And he looked like a deep sea diver. He had tanks on his back, big Mars rubber, and he was going around spraying all the trees with this Agent Orange, which had these stockpiles they used in the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
So
they yes.
could see the,
yes.
the people hiding in the forest.
Mm.
And this guy's skin was green, like a yellow green colour. Obviously, he was sick, you know.
Mm.
So I was in charge of the unit at the time, and I said, "We ain't using this stuff. It's a killer, you know." So you can stand up to it, but one man's waste is another man's profit. There's a lot of profit which is coming out of waste.
Absolutely.
It's not always a good thing. And the second point is, we was up in London, you saw it, and all of a sudden the big sign, we're giving away chocolate. And I thought, well, this sounds good. So we went in this little building, you had to watch a film first, and it was called Slave-Free Chocolate. And the idea was the plantations where they pick the beans, and it's normally kids that do it, they will give them a fair wage. So they go over there and make sure the kids get a fair wage. But the chocolate bar was three times the cost. And I'm thinking, you know, is this about profit or is this exploiting the slaves, you know? And I think the thing is that, can we escape this capitalist society? It is difficult because we're so entrenched in it. But if we think carefully, and also what you said about talk all the time, and when you spend your money, think exactly what you're spending it on.
Mm.
Yeah, the last little bit is very difficult, that spending, what you spend your money on, because everything is so mixed up. With, you know, one company is actually owned by another company. It's not what it says on the label. It's a much bigger company. You, it's very hard to know where that money's going. That I don't know about. On the thing about the defoliants and, you know, the nasty things on the thing. Does anybody look at? Bill looks at the conversation. I know it's on the website. It's like a daily news thing, and it's like from people who work at universities all around this country, and they were writing about all kinds of different stuff, all different subjects, and there's a lot of very interesting stuff there. And I noticed just the other day, I had to look at this one because I saw Rotherham on it, and Rotherham is the town near 2 miles from the village that I was born and brought up in. So I was interested. I looked at there. I couldn't believe my eyes. I suppose the council has decided who voted for it or what. I have no idea who they are. And the roads now into Rotherham are so beautiful. They've just mowed the edge bit so that it doesn't spoil your view, you know, you don't like corners and stuff. You can see clearly around corners, safe for people to cross. But the rest of it has been left naturally, and it's full of wildflowers of all kinds. It's something you rarely see here now, it seems to me, as a visitor. But that's just a little something that can be done, and that's capitalism. But if people have got the right mindset, we're going to make our place a little bit more beautiful. Actually, what I said there is fairly irrelevant, but very personal. Okay.
Right. Yeah, please.
Thank you. Oh, that was brilliant. I got loads from what you were saying.
Thank you.
Somebody was just saying about chocolate, and it's interesting because I was reading these posters outside here, and I think Cadbury, George Cadbury, was the person who founded Fircroft College. And yet, years down the line, wasn't Nestlé a big part of Cadbury's, and the company that was perpetuating all this lie about, you know, milk powder is better than breast milk and all this. And, you know, it just shows kind of like the corruption, the way things go, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The other thing that you were saying was about employment. And I think, you know, we talk about capitalism being all these things that the chap over here really eloquently said, you know, I don't know all of that, but, you know, for me, you know, it's very much about psychology and our prejudice as human beings, you know, in fact, not as human beings, as human doings, because, you know, to me, it's so much of, you know, success equates with, you know, what I earn.
Yes.
You know, it's not who I am. Mm. It's not kind of like my values, my moral compass, all of that. It's what I earn. Mm. And so, you know, a lot of people you'll find, you know, you meet somebody, oh, what do you do?
Mm. Yes.
You know, that's the first questions, isn't it? What do you do? Mm. And I remember going back to this walk that I said about yesterday, you know, with these kind of like very, pretentious, superficial people that, you know, what do you do? You know, these were the people who retired at, you know, 30, 40, you know, stockbrokers, the holiday homes, the skiing, the whatever. What do you do? And at one point, a chappy said, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a toilet cleaner. Because I wanted to kind of like, you know, just challenge him. And he said, oh, right. I said, oh, no, I'm not really. But, you know, I said, does it matter? You know, because you were saying about, you know, the jobs that people do. And I remember, actually, when I was a primary school teacher, until I realised that I wasn't education-shaped, you know, there was a child who said, you know, they wanted to be a cleaner. And I remember thinking, you know, my first instinct was to quell that, you know, a cleaner. You know, surely you want to be, you know, a CEO of a cleaning company or something, you know. But actually that child, you know, liked order, it liked things tidy and all of this sort of thing. And yet, you know, my instinct is to suppress that. And it's like, the jobs like gardening, cleaning, caring, you know, these unqualified jobs, you know, we have a kind of inbuilt, a lot of us, the prejudice about that. Or, you know, when I used to do caring, and, you know, I've got qualifications and whatever, but I did caring as well because I wanted to give something back. And people would think, you know, either I was a bit of a failure, you know, I wasn't using my degree for whatever, or that, you know, because I was going through a bit of a meltdown, that I was kind of channeling myself into this. You know, it wasn't for the pure essence of doing a work that was rewarding for me. And that's what I think is a big part of the problem. You know, that our value system is not on who we are, you know, as human beings. It's on what we do.
Yes.
You know, I don't know if that can ever be changed, but, you know, what can we do to make it more? You know, everybody is a part of a wheel, and we are all as important as each other, whether it's cleaning the streets or, you know, serving in a shop. Mm. You know, that person serving in a shop might have more impact on a person's life. You know, they might just touch another person's hand who is feeling suicidal that day or whatever. Mm. You know, it's, we all have a major part to play in.
Yeah.
Yeah, well said. Do you want to respond?
Well, yeah, just to add to it, really. I mean, I endorse what you're saying. I feel very much about that, that we're in socialism, we're going to need all these things done, the things that at the moment a lot of people might view as demeaning or whatever, but we know they all need doing. And the way I see it, really, is this. when you haven't got this stepped thing of wages or salary, whatever you want to call it, when nobody's going to get any of that, but everybody can go to the store, whatever we call it, and take the things that they want, need, you know, food, clothing, whatever it is, sort of thing, that we all have the same, what's the word?
Relationship.
We all have the same equal access. Yeah. And we do our bit, which whatever that will be. And I also believe because so many people will be released from what I see as a horrible handcuff job, you know, the financial world, where there's so many people rush into that. They go to university and they rush into that because they see that the salaries are up here, like you're saying, all these fantastic things they can do. Well, when they're not necessary to do that, they're going to have to put that intelligence that they've got to do something that's much... what I would suggest is worthwhile to the... Mm. community that they live in. Yeah, and for themselves. And it is perhaps, and when I say transition here, I don't mean like the old fashioned, well, we've got to take this many years to get there. No, I'm just talking about you couldn't say tomorrow we wake up and it's changed, because we all have to make our own transition, which will take different time. In the early days, perhaps might be the most challenging as far as that goes, because we're all fixed in a different kind of rut. But as time goes on, those things get sorted out, smoothed out, and people are developing and growing up with this new system, that will definitely become easier and more comfortable. You know, some people are going to resist because they don't understand or whatever. I think it will... That's all I see, is a transition thing, just getting used to it and getting things right and improving, whatever. And I can't see that it couldn't be a better time for everybody. And everybody will be valued, whatever it is.
There's a gentleman at the back, yeah? Mr. Chet, yes. Would you like to...
yes.
Oh, yeah, come in. Oh. No, go on, you go first.
Well... there's this wonderful quote, history, it repeats history first happens as a tragedy, then as a farce. Goebbels, if you tell a big enough lie often enough, people will believe it.
Yeah.
And now, of course, we've got Trump. Let's just say Boris Johnson, first as tragedy and now as a farce, and how you've got people out there who are sort of believing this, I can't think the word to describe it, but it's just it's propaganda.
Yes.
You know, as again Goebbels would have put it. So are we sort of unfortunately winding the clock back? We've got capitalism, which is now taking lessons off the Nazis. I can't find words to describe it, but it's that. It is exactly. And you've got to look round where I live, Acres Green, and there are all these signs plastered everywhere, spray painted. Free Tommy. Tommy who?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and of course, it's Tommy Robbins, yes. Now doing time for contempt of court, sort of thing. this man's a fascist, this is the other terrifying thing. We could very, very be heading for not just a right wing government, but actually a fascist one. So what? the mind bubbles. Thank you.
We've got some hard work.
Do you want to respond to next question? Next question.
Yeah.
Can I? Was it you, Celeste? Was it you, or was it someone near you that wanted to speak?
I think it was the one behind me.
Was it you? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Gentleman there, and then come over there. Would you like to give your point? Sorry. Gentleman in a check shirt. Yeah. That's it. Do you want to make your point?
Been waiting a lot longer.
Well, let me go first then.
Well, like a lot of people in this room, I just found the talk very inspiring and really, really great. If I may say so, I thought you kind of sold yourself slightly short by apologising about negativity, because one of the things you did was point out the rewards that can come from being part of a cooperative enterprise. Doing things for other people and so on. Those are really useful reminders. And it made me ponder on something I thought once or twice over the years. There are members who are in the party because they're against capitalism, and there are members who are in the party because they're in favour of socialism. And there can be quite a gulf between those two different stances. Then obviously there are people who are in the party for both reasons. Us normal people. And what I was wondering was, obviously the party has to do both things. If we're going to create a socialist consciousness, we need to point out the awful system that we're living in and point out that there's an alternative to it. But I just wonder if we shifted the balance slightly between those two things, people might be more receptive. If we emphasise a bit more the possibilities of socialism, that, you know, people may be more receptive to a positive message than a negative message. Just a thought.
Yeah. If I would like to answer that, if I may.
Yes, yes.
Is that all right?
Yeah, sure,
yeah,
sure.
Sorry.
But Celeste is the next one.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I would like to answer that one because I really identify with what you said. I lived most of my life as a... I didn't know about socialism. I knew it as a word, as a something, when I was in London as a student, all in the 60s. We would have discussions about this, that and the other. But I never came across anything that was actually happening or anywhere I could go. I never found anywhere. And I suppose it wasn't so easy then either, because you hadn't got the internet. But when I actually did stumble upon the party, and I still can't remember if it was a small ad in either New Internationalist or Private Eye, and I thought, this looks interesting. And that was, I don't know, 15, 16 years ago. I can't remember exactly. And I sent for it. I said, right, send me this stuff. Okay. And I read it. I thought, man, this is interesting. I want more of that. And this is all done by post from Turkey. Post, okay? Send me more. And they sent me more. Okay, I'm in. Oh, no, you can't do that. But the only point I'm trying to make, I got to that age in my life and I'd never stumbled across socialism before. But all my life, that's what I identified with. When I read the stuff, I knew. That's how I'd been. That was what I was. Because that's what I did in my life. That's how I related to people. Or, yes, I was working. But I also did things around the village or with youngsters. Or because I wanted to. Just sharing, whatever it was. And so eventually when they said, okay, and so I wrote longhand my answer to the questions and posted them. Oh, and got my reply. I was so pleased. You know, it was fantastic. But it's that thing, and I'm sure I can't believe I'm the only person in the world who feels like that but doesn't know about it. So I'm looking for more, you know, that's what I'm looking for wherever I go. Okay? Thank you for bringing it up, though. It was great.
Celeste?
I'll try.
Yeah, go on, please.
I think I'm the only foreigner here, so I feel...
No foreigners in the Socialist Party.
I really like the point you talk about the lies and the propaganda. I feel that, as a gentleman added that I think when the lies is repeated, it becomes the truth,
yes,
isn't it? So one question is, Do you believe that, relating to these lies, there are some lies on the books as well in the primary or secondary school? Think about the world the youngest is going to live in. It makes sense. Do you believe that in the books taught in the primary and the secondary school, are there some lies, for example, or is missing chapters like using the human resource related to the final product or the final service we buy on? Perhaps I just thought about that, because I do believe if the capitalist has a soul, there will be a socialism. That's my belief. And my worries as well is that at the moment, for example, in my country, all the books about Marxism is banned from university, and the university as well as primary schools are pretty much targeted. Yeah? The university only smoking marijuana and so far, and parties, they are not thinking. And socialism is a word that you don't bear to say it, otherwise it's going to help. Because you talk about the religion as well, and I think the religion has a big part. Okay, so I think it's a lot of different things, but I think my question is, if you believe that there are some lies in the books too, so the people are still this lethargic thinking, and what the socialists can do about that.
I wonder what you think I did to earn my living for a lot of years in my life. I was a teacher. That's okay. But long term, it wasn't a good choice for me, because I was very disappointed at what happened in schools. I did a couple of years primary school because I couldn't bear to go and teach music, which is what I'd trained to do. I couldn't bear to go and do that. So I went into primary school teaching for a couple of years, and then I got out of it for a number of years and did something else because I wasn't comfortable with how it was going. But that was from the 60s, middle to late 60s. And then when I got back to it, I was in comprehensive school teaching 11 to 16-year-olds. And what do you say about, are there lies in books? Now, whether it's actually lies, I mean, I was very, very discomforted. I was very discomforted by much of what happened. And at meetings, I'm afraid I was a thorn in the side of a lot of people, because I would bring things up that I really wasn't comfortable with, happy with, or whatever. There's certainly so much missing from what the kids should have. And also, and don't forget, I haven't been in the classroom now for 20 years. Retired early and went away. But so I'm really not au fait with what's going on now in this country. But then it was very much that everything was along these lines. You don't get off the lines. This is English. This is history. This is whatever. And then you choose something as you go along. And it leaves so much to be desired, and there's so little for free thought, free choice. It was like that. Is anybody doing it now and can add to that for what's happened in the last 20 years? I'd be happy to hear it. But yet there is, and I think that we won't have socialism. We won't have schools like we've got now. You see, one thing that I find really ridiculous. See, when I went to that comprehensive school, they had lots of practical lessons, practical classes. And as the years went by, they stopped. They can't do that. It's got to be all classroom stuff. No sort of machinery or no knocking things about or cutting things about. And it all became very much on paper. And you sort of think, you know, a lot of the kids, for several years, I taught what were then called special needs, in slightly smaller groups than the big ones. Those kids couldn't put up with up till 16 years old, trying to do the things they've been trying to do. They already failed miserably at primary school. And now we're going to put them another 5 years to fail again at the same things? Come on. So it's not structured. It's not there to help individuals. It's just there to program everybody and shove them out the end. And, you know, you want a conveyor belt type thing. That's how very much how very negative about it I am. There's so much that needs to be changed. And there's no doubt that we would do it a very, very different way. I can't imagine, but it would, perhaps I'll work on this. But it would definitely be a totally, totally... I think it would bear very little resemblance to what we've got now. I really do. You recognise what special... You know, some kids are really into insects, aren't they? Or dinosaurs.
Yeah?
Well, okay, let's build some. Let's build on that. Let's build on that. We've got to put them all together, and they've got to all learn and draw pictures and learn about, I don't know, something else that they're not really, you know, they don't even know what it is, they're not bothered about. But I think everybody needs to, God's sake, we're so varied. Some of us are technical in our outlook, some of us are artistic in our outlook, some of us are musical. There's just so many different ways to go. And if that's not noticed in individuals, and they're given the opportunity to blossom at this, then what are we doing? Why are we turning out people who've got to have, what do they call it, is it GCSE, 5 GCSEs, or grade Cs, or blah, blah, blah? Come on, it's not, it's wrong somehow, it's very wrong. Yes, we want training, we need training. But people, it should be self-select along the way, I think. It needs to be much, much broader, much, much broader than it is. Did I answer?
I'm just going to pause for a minute. That's what was being said there. There's an interesting book called De Schooling Society by Ivan Illich, which is worth a read, because he looks into all that business. Well, anyway. So first of all, it's going to be Glenn and then Tim. Glenn, did you put your hand up? You did,
yes,
didn't
please.
So it's you first and then Tim, okay? Please.
Just briefly then, a couple of points. I think Janet was talking about some of the negative things, and I think what's going on at the moment in society is a huge amount of negativity, so much so that the medical world are taking a lot of presentations from people who are genuinely now mentally worried about what's going to happen in the future. And I think the idea of suggesting that, as the speaker did last night, with all due respect to the speaker last night, there was a suggestion that if socialism was to be achieved, it would take possibly, I think he may have used the term millennia, but either, if I'm incorrect there, it was suggested that it would take a huge amount of time, a huge amount of time. I must say, I'd like to dispute that. And the reason being, he used an example of a Paleolithic and Mesolithic transformation into the Neolithic army. And in actual fact, a friend of mine, she's an archaeologist on Orkney, and has done a massive, massive amount of work on this, has suggested from evidence that transition from Paleolithic hunter-gatherer to Neolithic farming methods happened in a matter of a generation. It was incredibly quick. So I think as socialists living in a capitalist society, if we began to think that this was going to take 50 years, 100 years, millennia, we might as well give up now, because in reality, what is going on in the world around us is now becoming very, very urgent indeed. So you can't really have any hope if you're thinking it's going to take millennia, because you might as well give up. And I think the other problem we face is, I'll be brief here because other people want to speak, but the other problem we face is that I've been associated with the SPGB now for 40 years. There was a slight lapse in the middle of course. I stopped just because my career working life demanded too much of me to be involved. But in 40 years, I would suggest, and unless anyone can tell me otherwise, that the numbers don't seem to be increasing greatly. This number of people seems to be the sort of number that I've been used to seeing. So what is not happening is a greater understanding of these concepts. Now, I was talking to someone this morning, and most of the time, if you're conversing with people about socialism, and I think it was James I was talking to, you could be an hour down a line of conversation sharing ideas, as Janet was suggesting, and I think we do have to do that. And at the end of that hour, you think, right, they're seeing this, and they're saying they're seeing it, and then they say, well, how do people buy stuff then? And you get that anything up. You realise. So what I'm trying to say here is that there is an urgency in society at the moment, and I think, like it or not, Extinction Rebellion have got vastly more people than the SBGP have. Vastly more. But, and I don't, when I, and I've attended some of their meetings, not as a member, but just to try and hear what they're about, if you like. Now, you may have seen some of the demonstrations, and they're saying system change, not climate change. That all sounds quite laudable, and it all sounds like something we might latch on to. But in reality, from my experience of talking to them, they don't seem to know what they want to change to, but they do want change. So I kind of wonder whether the sort of people here, like all of us, who aren't increasing in number, but what we do share in common, it seems to me, is an ability to understand how this concept might work. The vast majority of people, as often demonstrated in the conversations I've just said about, don't, but they do want to get somewhere. So I think maybe some, if we're going to have conversations, it may be with the sorts of Extinction Rebellion type of people that we want to be having those conversations with, because clearly they want change, but maybe they can't perceive what they want to change to just now. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tim? And then, yeah, I'll add them afterwards.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on the education and a couple of two things that Ben said. I'd just like to briefly say something about truth, because I think there's a real danger, especially in the current climate, that truth is being propagated, and it's in fact propaganda. The idea that there's somehow a truth, and that for example, a state propaganda organisation like the BBC can tell us that through a fact checker is propaganda in itself. And so I wouldn't blame Trump or Boris Johnson. It's evident that they're lying, but then you've got a lot of the so-called liberal media in America now picking up the same kind of attack with Boris Johnson as they did with Trump, and hammering him as if somehow there's a liberal truth. You know, we could go back to Blair or something like that. So I think there is a real danger that people that are peddling truth are really peddling propaganda. So I think that needs to be cautioned about. On the education thing, Janet partly picked up on it, but I agree with Kevin, the liberation of theologists in South America, Illich and Freire and others. This is an interesting experiment. But Glenn's point about the urgency of the situation, of trying to get more and more people to see that socialism is the answer. I mean, look back at the sort of pseudo-socialist communist regimes. That urgency, coupled with the ideology, usually leads to authoritarianism. And the first place that occurs is in education, through indoctrination. So I wonder whether Janet had any broad view about what an education system would look like so that it didn't emulate that kind of authoritarian indoctrination process that's been such a feature of other regimes.
Yes, where do I start with that? Let's just say some of the things that are wrong with the current one. One of them's got to be, first of all, at what age you start school. If your birthday falls before a certain date, you're in this class. If your birthday is the next day, you're in that class. Yes. Nonsense. You know, do you understand what I mean? Yeah, you can be your birthday's in August, and you are the youngest in that class. You're born 5 days later and you're the oldest in the next group. That's one thing that's silly. So it should be when an individual is ready, if you like. And I think there should be flexibility about it. There should be no sort of age that you say, you will go now, or you know. That's one thing. Class sizes is another huge thing that needs change. It's ridiculous to have, I don't know, 30 plus children in a group here. It's they can have no individual attention. That's another thing. It's where I think it has to be so much more flexible, and we seem the schools seem to get bigger and bigger, and I don't really understand what the thing about that is. It seems to me it'd be far better off. Okay, in specialist things, you're going to need to go to specialist places with the right equipment and whatnot another, but children need to be dealt with as individual people, not as just numbers. And they need to be, it's like, are they, what are they looking for? At what age do you know that you want to find out about this? It might not be what you're going to do for the rest of your life, it doesn't matter. But you need to have the options to move, transfer. I'm talking on a very abstract level, I know, but I just foresee something that's, and like I said earlier, it's something I will think about a lot more now, and I've got half of this book name written down. Because it is crucial. It absolutely is crucial because we've all been through it and we've come to a point, and I bet we can all look back on it and we see some good things that happened. Of course, yes, of course we will. But I bet a lot of us, I've heard people say they don't remember a thing about what happened in their history lesson. I don't remember what happened in my history lesson. I did it to O level. And the man was so boring, the way he talked to us, and his voice went down, and he'd cough. And then he'd up again, and he'd up, and he'd cough. And for God's sake, you'd sit there for 40 minutes, and you'd come out, and then you'd say, God, you know, do you see what I'm saying? So that's another thing that has to change. And why have you got to continue with it? Because you've chosen it, or you've been put into that, and you know after a month that you could please let me out of here. For, you know, it's just, why has it got to be like that? It's so set in stone, and everything needs to change. Just about everything needs to change. Can I see how many other people have been in teaching here, please? Look at them all. Come on, then, because you'd say something, you people. Your turn.
Well, Adam, and then on to you. You can come back that after Hal.
I was just going to go quickly on something just very interesting in regards to earlier what you were saying about how students need to have the ability to develop their education to be able to be more free. From what we've seen, I mean, currently within the education system in the UK, you've got things like forest schools that are able to give, you know, that flexibility to some students to be able to choose what they want to do and not be so exam-based. But the other thing that I've not seen this from, no offence, is giving students the ability to be educated, politically educated within education from a younger age. And the thing is that choice from about 11, from year 7 onwards, 11 and up, most students aren't given the ability to choose, you know, what kind of political education they want. Like, to learn about that, to give them essentially a whole area of ideas, whether they may be from communism to stranger ideas. And that has been a big holdback within education. And in the socialist world, we may go back on the ideas of, you know, what the capitalist system would, but to still have that option. And I think that's very important. But that is something that most countries, whether they be communist, fascist, anything else, they won't touch that. That's become the thing at the moment. And I was wondering, like, even in the socialist world, do you agree, or how do you see political education being brought into students from about 11 plus onwards?
Are you ready to answer that one?
Well, no, all I want to say is that somebody once said that capitalism is a disimagination machine. And I think we need to use our imaginations when talking about things like education and socialism. We don't know how an education how an education system in socialism would work.
No.
We may well decide not to have schools.
Yes.
The chair mentioned the book by Ivan Illich, Deschooling Society. Very good book indeed. Mm. And even in this society, quite a lot of kids don't go to school, they're educated at home. Mm. Who knows how it will work?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't think we can sort of lay down rules now as to how education will work within socialism. It will work in the way that the people who establish socialism see it as appropriate to actually serve the society.
Yes. And also, I wouldn't sort of say children from 11. It's a life thing. You don't suddenly start talking about something at that age because you think they can understand. The questions come. You know, I think about like my son when he was little. We didn't use little words; we just used normal words, and he learnt the normal words. And if he wanted to know what a penis was, it's a penis, for instance. No silly words or whatever it is. We just used the correct words, and he used them no problem, and he knew what they were. And I think we're trying to compartmentalise too much. Yeah, with age or subject, what age should they start to learn this subject? Well, they start to learn it when they're ready to learn it, and when kids show interest in something, that's when they're best going to learn something.
Okay. So, the gentleman, want to check shirt and then you, Bill? Okay.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, I was luckier than Janice in my choice of history teacher. Our guy used to give us a flavour of pre-war Berlin by singing the cabaret songs.
Oh, all right.
I wanted to pick up on Ben's point and say I absolutely agree with the urgency of socialism. And I think that's one reason amongst many others why the party has to stand absolutely four square on rejection of reformism.
Yes.
We haven't got time for reforms.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
The issue about this is urgent.
Yes.
Let me just throw into that three statistics and invite you to decide which of them you want to concentrate on. The party's half the size it was 20 years ago. It's a quarter of the size it was 40 years ago. But hey, it's twice the size it was when we started.
Yay.
We got off to a good start then, didn't we? Right, Bill?
So I was going to make just a couple of points, but I've been reminded of an anecdote. When I was in primary school, our teacher was trying to explain to us about the general election, and I don't think I quite got what was going on. So as a very small child, she sent children off to stand in various places, corresponding to which party they wanted to vote for. And I didn't get it, and then a small group went off and stood for one party. And then I thought, oh, now I've got to vote for one of these other ones. We joined a much larger group and went off to the other side. So I'm ashamed to say that in the 1983 general election, I voted for Margaret Thatcher. At the age of seven. So, yes, but the idea that we should teach democracy as a practical thing in schools, and not just as a thing taught, but as a thing practiced and experienced in daily life is something that obviously would have to happen, I think, in any meaningful socialism. But just a couple of points further. On lying and cynicism, which, as I said last night, seems to be unreasonably effective, the lies, there has been studies that more or less prove that we respond not to the facts, but to the person putting them forward. And we're very strongly, if someone in the Labour Party hears Jeremy Corbyn say, the directions to the shop, they'll believe it, but if Boris Johnson gave the directions to the shop, they would just automatically disbelieve it. And it's just, it seems to me that we're not, these rational beings that, the logic textbooks tell us they are. We're very much social beings. But by the same token, that the sheer cynicism which the lie is used, to get socialism, need to organise ourselves. And the problem with open organisations is that they are supremely vulnerable to attack by simple, the CIA Guide to Sabotage published in the 1940s says, keep bringing up procedural points. Keep bringing up points of order. Keep going back to the rule book with a rigidity, because all you have to do is constantly cause dissent and slow everything down by, either lying, using the system. But basically, my point is that we have to avoid the tyranny of structurelessness by having political organisations, but at the same time, we're very vulnerable to political organisations being hijacked, used against us, and it does seem to, this is the point Keith just made, we don't grow as a party ourselves, I suppose, but that's one of the ways that they disarm us, is by making it hard to grow a party.
Can I just ask, because there have been some questions, we've had a fair amount of questions, that anyone who's not spoken would like to ask a question? If not, I shall go to the gentleman there with his hand on his beard.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Thank you. My name's Alan, by the way. It's just education and when a child is supposedly old enough to take it in. When I was in secondary school, we didn't have any sex education. What we got was the reproductive life cycle of the chicken, which doesn't really prepare you for adult life. And I'm not kidding,
Which goes
first? Exactly. I mean, basically, when I started dating, I'd occasionally cluck at people.
Thank you.
That was a well laid out question.
Cracking, wasn't it?
Cracking, yeah. That's the last joke on that one. Now, can someone who hasn't spoken, please?
No, I'm going to wait.
You sure, Jackman?
Yes, I am.
I want to hear your pulse at the time.
I'll throw it out there.
Go on.
What is the title of this talk again?
Can't remember.
I've got my book here.
Short-term memory, sorry.
I've got my book here.
I have to look at it.
Living in capitalism as a socialist. Well, I'm a human being, but what I notice more is I have to protect myself from the dire crap that is all around me. From the moment I step out of my council flat that I still have, having nearly been thrown out under bedroom tax and all that shite, I pass people who are obviously mentally not well.
Mm-hmm.
I have people in my family who are mentally not well. I avoid them. Not because I want to, but I just can't cope with it. I cannot cope with this constant, you don't know what's happening. You know they're in pain, you know they're hurting, but you can't do anything about it. It's not always about money. You know, some people take in so much, particularly young people, I've noticed, because I know that it's rising, mental health amongst the young, males, girls, you know, it is really a bad thing. We are going to inherit all this. All this will be part and parcel of the disaster that capitalism has brought, because it all stems from the shit. I know people who cry constantly, and I'm talking not crocodile tears, but weeping. You know, Jesus never wept. I know people who weep because of what they see going on. And it's usually people who are in a poor position themselves, not necessarily money-wise, but they just have this fragility about them that they can't cope with what capitalism is throwing at us every sodding day while we're being battered right, left and centre. What do you do to be a human? I mean, I don't step over people sleeping under the duvets on Clapham High Street, but I try and avoid them. I actually cross the road, but you can't avoid them because there's two sitting under the ATM, there's another three sleeping under the bridge. This is round head office.
Yes.
That high street. And yet the young and the pretty and the so-called millennials and the coffee shops and the crap that's been thrown at us, the chicken shops and, you know, all the rubbish, you get a burger for a pound and stuff, and you know, the size of some people. I know I'm not supposed to say this, but when you see children who are so rotund, if that's the word, literally wobbling down the street, it's hurtful. It's the shit food that we have to eat, the crap that we have to put up with all the time, and you see babies being done with the same thing. You know, what do you do? How do you protect yourself for the shit of capitalism, that you don't want to see another human suffering, when you can't turn on the television because they're being bombed over there, that they're fleeing war over there, we're saying we're not letting them in here, they're dying in the waters, unless it's, you know, some child who happens to have blonde hair, blue eyes, yes, nice, pretty-looking face, who's been to Spain and maybe fell off a £3,000 joyride, that poor kids never get a look in, we're not supposed to feel anything.
Yes.
It's, you know, I have to put myself... I'm isolated. I'm not on the internet. I'm going to get on it next thing. But as a member, I am totally isolated from anyone who... You know, this is the one time. I can't do branches, they're too bureaucratic. You can't even know who you're sitting next to in a branch. And I will say they've got to change branches. Business can wait, you know. What is the business? Upgrade the whiteboard on the internet. Do this. It's the same old shite. If you want branches, let us talk. Let us at least ask, where are you from? How long have you been a member? I mean, I used to go to branches, didn't know who I'm talking. The thing is ridiculous. We need, you know, we as socialists need to protect ourselves so that there'll be someone, you know, around, you know, seeing how the young, because it's the young who are going to have to do this.
Yes.
And they will hopefully not be our age by the time this happens. You know, because I'm a great believer. Anything can happen. You know, seatbelts came in practically overnight. Vegetarianism took off practically overnight. No smoking in pubs, for frack's sake. I gave birth in hospital to my daughter in the 1960s. I had a fag in one hand, 16-year-old girl. It was all legal. They told us if you smoked, you've got a smaller baby. Of course, we were puffing away like crazy. I mean, the things change. You wouldn't dream of going in to give birth and having a fag. it wouldn't be known, and yet it was legal.
Things change, is what you're saying.
Exactly, and I think it's going to be changing quicker because people have had enough of this nonsense. You know, you can't eat money, it's true.
I'd like to thank you for that very colourful contribution.
Yes.
Have you got time to respond?
No, what you said is perfect. Yeah.
Right.
You know, it's isolation for some of us.
Well, it's very good. Alienation as well.
Definitely.
Right then, who's going to put their hand up next?
Lunchtime.
No, I don't think it is it?
One more before... Come on, be brave.
What about you, Ed?
I'm trying to do two jobs at once. I'm a man.
Multitask.
My name's
Stephen
Shack.
Go on, Stephen.
I quite often don't agree with Jackie, but I agree with everything she said. I agree about branches. When I first used to go to branches in the Briary Rose in Birmingham, all we did was correspondence and business. And I thought, well, it's not very good.
No.
What we need is some discussion. We eventually got to discuss some items, but unfortunately now it's all online.
Yeah.
We have to do our branch meetings online because not enough of us can get to a branch meeting to fill the form.
Yeah, and we've
got that. Yeah, branches should have put an item for discussion on all the time.
Well, perhaps in some of the remaining period while we're here, we could maybe open up a little area for discussion about branches. Are they working? Are they not working? Whatever. And if we're talking about branches in a sort of larger perspective, perhaps we could consider setting up the Olive Branch so that Jack and Ian could join that one.
that's a good shout. Actually, I think it's a perfect opportunity to try and build and develop on that, to have an open discussion, because it's so mundane, soul destroying branch meetings.
Well,
you know, it's enough to put anybody off.
Particularly when you've got visitors or guests arriving, they've got to sit through listening to all that. And then a quick rush at the end, because we're all rushing off for trains or transport or stuff. We've done ourselves no favours, I don't think, over the decades with some of the branches that we've done. And we've lost so many good branches. It's a shame.
Any more? I would like to milk on something, a discussion about the education business. I think there's a book by A.S. Neil, and I can't remember what the title of it is.
Summerhill.
And that was a different method of teaching children, I believe.
Yes.
So if anyone, you know, it's in the teaching profession or not, would like to comment on that, if they've got any awareness of it or knowledge about
it. A child died, didn't they, and it got closed down. drowned in the ponds that Steiner schools or woodcraft folk are another ways of Montessori.
Yeah.
They have ways of doing education.
It's just that I've got a very limited knowledge about this, but apparently the processes they took with the children's education were very different. I think some of it was about finding out what the child wanted to do rather than having a dogma of what they've got to learn.
Exactly. Mm.
So I don't... Do you know anything about that, Howard, or gentlemen there?
They gave the children more freedom.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a teacher, and I mentioned summer help, this one of the teachers, they thought it was self-indulgent, really.
Yeah.
You know, because they were dealing with comprehensive kids and things, you know. So they thought Summerhill was a bit of a luxury for middle-class people.
Yes.
They couldn't afford it, right? But it was an awful idea, but it gave the individual more freedom. And if you didn't want to go to a lesson, you didn't have to, right? You know, they gave them much more freedom. But some of the teachers I talked to thought it was a bit self-indulgent, right?
I know that they have tried to promote that. My oldest daughter's a primary school teacher. And they are trying to promote that in Scotland at the moment now, focused more on building a child's strengths, you know, maybe one or two subjects going on at any one time, and try to give the class more of an input in what they're taught rather than how they're taught. That's another conversation. But certainly they are trying to build more flexibility into, I think it's called the McCone system. Yeah. They're really trying to shake up the education system in Scotland at the moment. A bit with a lot of resistance to begin with, but more and more teachers are starting to warm to it now that it does have its benefits. Maximum class sizes as well, not allowed to more than 24 kids in a class. Teachers have got to have at least 2 hours a week to do you know, their own time. So they are trying to improve things. Never be perfect, that's for sure. It can't be under the system that we have to endure at the moment. But there's certainly there is more input from teachers and the unions and the kids and the parents now, and they are doing their very best to try and improve it. You know.
Well, I've never taught, but I would imagine that children, as well as knowing multiplication tables and where to put a full stop and comma, needs to be enjoying their education.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Something that, you know, the teacher's empowered to teach them, and the children learn from a teacher, and that's Weber. Because otherwise we go into this murky world of, it's a book by Dickens, when a horse was described as a quadruped. I can't remember the...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That's it. The beautiful horse was a quadruped according to this particular teacher, because everything was reduced to a factual thing rather than being a beautiful thing. So, you know, that's... I was lucky to be educated at Ruskin when I was a much older age. When I was just a bit younger than I am now, like 2 minutes ago, I'd have never had it before. And it was quite awakening for me to be studying as a mature student with people my own age and much younger. And I think we learnt as much around the canteen table discussing things afterwards as we did in the classroom. So,
I know that again, you know, it being sort of like a generational thing. I don't know if anyone's familiar, a lot of the older people in the room will maybe remember Andy Armitage from Glasgow Branch, you know, if the name's familiar, most of you will remember. Well, Andy Armitage was a branch member, very, very dedicated, committed member, and he was actually my daughter's primary school teacher.
Okay.
And a lot of his kind of attitude to teaching has obviously rubbed off onto her, and also been brought up within a socialist family environment. I think that is obviously having an impact as well. And she's
that's excellent.
I don't want to start blowing a trumpet kind of thing, but a lot of it is down to attitudinal kind of teachings as well. You know, you were referring to this lady girl here was saying about would you want to be, what do you want to do? You know, of course, many parents want to be with their kids is, I want to be a doctor, and I want to be a train driver, or whatever. Well, with one girl sort of got in the class, saying, I want to work in the checkouts at Aldi or something like that, and that got a bit of a laugh. And then straight away, she's like, you know, it's not funny, we've all got a role to play, kind of thing, trying to install that kind of positive attitude in the class rather than it being frowned upon, kind of thing. You know, you're not setting your aspirations,
Well, I'll take the opportunity.
Be the best you can be, kind of thing, or whatever service that's very good,
and I'll take the opportunity to ask the young lady again to expand on that.
But no, I just wanted to.
Right.
Jacqueline was saying about every time she goes out in the morning, I have to protect myself.
Yeah.
And that's something that I feel as well. It's almost like I have to consciously put myself in a bubble kind of thing. And I just wondered, kind of being new to socialism or whatever, you know, are socialist people, you know, are we kind of life's empaths? You know, are we the sensitive people in life that, you know, I just wondered about that, because I feel it, you know, seeing more injustice and whatever, you know, maybe that is a kind of distinguishing factor of us, that we are the empathic ones, the more empathic ones out there. I don't know. Just wondered what.
I think that that is the default position in human beings. I think most people are naturally empathetic, but it's drained out of you, you know, by your environment as you're going through school and
beyond. Or you're driven mad, or mentally unstable, or something like that. Or you turn to things that hurt you, you know, severe drugs or pharmaceuticals, the legal drugs.
If you don't mind me saying, I'll go more into it, but I finally take the plunge and put together an article for The Standard, because it seems to be all the rage just now, this whole kind of mental health thing, and rightly so. And I've titled it Mental Health in a Mad, Mad World. It's currently just being sort of reviewed by Adam at the moment, Adam Buick, because obviously Adam's a really highly skilled writer, unlike myself. So he's just fine-tuning it and tweaking it a little bit, and it should be going into The Standard any issue now, I hope. And so please look out for that, because I think I feel anyway that it's written from my head and my heart. Having experienced and having been on antidepressants for the best part of 30 years now, you know. And of course, there was a time as a guy you would never own up to that kind of thing, but now at least people are discussing it and being open about it. I think that can only be a good thing. But that should be coming up soon, and I hope it meets with a lot of approval. I really do. And
it's probably one of the biggest cover-ups that capitalism's done.
Oh, yeah.
The sheer scale of mental problems around the world, either caused by capitalism.
Carla, would you like to?
Yeah, can I just plug the session later on this evening?
Right.
Because that's an evening of personal stories. And before we all come out with our personal stories now, it would be great to have all our personal stories and how we feel and how it's affected us. And we can save that for this evening.
Great.
See you all this evening.
Look forward to it.
Great
timing.
We can all cry together.
Great timing, Carla.
Laugh.
Good timing.
Is that before or after the alcohol?
Yeah. So, have we got any more time?
I don't know. I think people have had enough now.
Okay, unless there's no more questions, we'll call it a day.
Thank you.